In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Food Network Obsessed. This is the podcast where we dish on all things food with your favorite chefs, food influencers, and Food Network stars. I'm your host, Jamie Sire, and today we have an Iron Chef from the Cali-Mexico border to talk about her multicultural culinary approach and favorite festive traditions. She is a chef, restaurateur, and she is cooking alongside Selena Gomez on Selena Plus Chef Home for the Holidays. It's Claudette Cepeda. Claudette, welcome to the podcast. You have been very busy lately. Any pinch me moments that you can share with us?
Well, recently I was invited to the UAE for a American Chef diplomat trip, and I was able to stand at the very highest point of the Burj Khalifa and just really reflect on the last 23 years in this industry and where it's gotten me and where it's taken me. And it's incredible. So that was definitely a pinch me moment. Like if little Claudette could have seen that.
I mean, what are your reflections on the last 23 years?
So much pain, so much growth. Thankful for every single scar, bump, bruise that I have. Thankful for the you know, band of misfits, the family that I've chosen over the last two decades in this industry. That really champion me. I champion them. They say, you know, they say that, you know, the friends you should have are the ones that say your name in the rooms you're not in. And I think I definitely, that is one of the biggest reflection points that I wholeheartedly can say that that happens.
That's incredible. You have described yourself as a border kid, you know, growing up between Tijuana and San Diego. How did straddling those two cultures kind of shape who you are as a person and as a chef?
I still do it. You know, I don't think that I'll ever not have a foot in each country. And I am trying to teach my kids that curiosity to, like, if I can't teach them something, for them to seek it out and try to learn. But the biggest thing that being a border kid has given me is, I think, empathy for sure. I grew up hearing tons of different languages, people that didn't look like me. You know, every single ethnicity gets truncated at the border when they're facing their own political crisis. They end up in a border to the United States, and Tijuana happens to be the busiest port of entry in the world. So I think it made me a very empathetic human. It made me a human that was easily adaptable to any situation, because when things get a little crazy, that's when I feel I am the best,
really?
Which is a trait that most chefs have, but I definitely thrive in chaos. And I don't think there's anything more chaotic than the border on a busy day.
That's absolutely true. I lived in San Diego for a few years, so I can totally picture what you're talking about. When you think about food memories from that time in your life, do you have a specific one that you can kind of pinpoint as the genesis of your journey as a chef?
You know, it's so funny. In the reflection, I'm currently writing my cookbook, and the cookbook is called Borderlands. And so I reflect on the first chapter is called matriarchs, the food off my matriarch's hips, you know, and it's like, we were hip children in the kitchen usually. And I was such a voracious eater. When people asked me for pictures as a cook, when I was cooking when I was little, I was like, no, like kids aren't usually like, even to this day, anyone comes into my kitchen, I'm like, get out, get out. We have a saying in Spanish says, mucho ayuda el que no estorba. It's like more help whoever doesn't get in the way. Like that's the biggest help we have. Just get the hell out.
Get out.
And yeah, it's like my grandma would always just say like, no, you're better off outside. Like just get out of my way and I'll have it done faster. So the control freak came in generationally. But I think the biggest memories that I have are sitting around the table. Like my food memories are like breaking bread with my family members. I had a cousin who was 4 days older than me by 1 year and 4 days. So she was August 13th. I was August 17th. So every birthday became this huge celebration of like tandem birthday cakes because it was just easier. My family was kind of didn't really think of the trauma it would cause having to share a birthday. But I will say that my house, since I was born into my teen years before my family lost it all, before was always the meeting point for our families in San Diego. And then in Guadalajara, it was my aunt's restaurant. So I was always, the biggest food memories are the hum of a group of Mexicans that sound like they are fighting to the death. But really, they're just like really passionate of whatever they're talking about. Like, we love you as much as we hate. Like, we love with such passion and we also hate with such passion. You don't really know which is which.
Everything's passionate.
Yes. And I think we encompass that. And I get chills thinking about it. But that my food memories come from being around the table and eating nonstop. We're having breakfast and thinking about what we're having for lunch. And we're having lunch and thinking about what we're having for dinner. Like, insatiable palates.
You mentioned some of your, you know, your family members. Who in your life really taught you how to cook?
So riddle me this, Batman. Are you born knowing how to cook? Is that an innate trait that you have? Or is it teachable? I think what I tell my cooks is I can teach you how to cook like me, but I can't teach you wanting to know how to cook. Like wanting that like, again, that insatiable curiosity of getting something right, becoming so hell-bent on getting a recipe right, even though you've done it 10 times and you're never satisfied, that is something that innately is like in you. So I think that knowing, like, I call it cook swag. It's like that the fluidity in a kitchen you're born with. So for me, the people that, again, I was never really allowed in the kitchen. I was always a kid in between people's legs, like asking questions and eating and sneaking snacks. But growing up in my house in Tijuana, my mom's mom helped raise us. My abuelita Paula, which she's my spirit guide. She's my angel. And she was my roommate up until my teen years. She taught me how, and I don't know if your mother's like this. I feel like this is culturally changes. It doesn't matter where you're from, but moms and grandmas have a really specific talent on opening the refrigerator door and making a 3-course meal when you just opened it and said, there's nothing to eat.
There's nothing to eat.
There's nothing to eat. The food is like bursting out of the pantries and the refrigerators and you like are just so helpless. You're like, I still do it because I'm not. I think because I became a teen mom, it won't happen until I hit a specific age. But my grandmother taught me how to make a lot with very little. My mom's mom. Mm. And my going to Guadalajara, splitting my time between both parts of Mexico. And in Guadalajara, my aunt had a restaurant from the 70s. She started a 10-table plastic table restaurant selling pozole, turned into a full-fledged, full-service restaurant that was a meeting point for our family and many different families generationally. My aunt knew when someone was getting baptized, married, died. It was just, she was the hostess with the mostest. So the food part in Guadalajara became how to be the hostess with the mostest, how to treat people in your space like they were family. So I think that comes, and obviously like the pozole was the one woman made the pozole at my aunt's restaurant, Doña Moni. You could hear her sandals sliding into the terracotta tiles as she was coming in. It was a because she couldn't lift her legs. A woman could barely walk, but that was her domain. And I was the only one allowed in to help her make the garnishes or shred the pork. So yeah, it very specific core memories come of loving food the way I do.
I love that. I love those stories because you can really, you can hear in your voice and as you're recalling some of these things, like how it just kind of transports you, you know, back to that, that point in time and your love for it really, really comes through. What parts of your Mexican heritage are crucial in your opinion to kind of bring forth in your everyday life and also in your food?
Oh God, I don't think I've ever been asked that question. Thank you for that. Cause I feel like sometimes it gets redundant on these questions. You amazing interviewer. Well, I will say adaptability, definitely. It comes through in my flavors. You know, people always give me kudos when I go do a shoot or I go do, you know, an appearance and they're like, chef, we couldn't get XYZ. I just kind of go, it's okay. Like, it's not the end of the world. Other chefs would literally freak out because they're so stuck in their ways. And I am very fluid in that the magic that I do doesn't necessarily, I can create a lot with a little. Like that, my grandmother is like that. That I have her like sitting on my shoulder. She's like the good and the bad angel sitting on my shoulder, and it's that. And then I would say that what makes my food specifically like where I pull from is in Tijuana. Being raised in Tijuana in the Baja region, it's a very specific flavor profile that the rest of the country doesn't necessarily have so keenly attuned, and it's the high acid, high salt, high chile. Like if it's supposed to be spicy, it's gonna be spicy, but we also know how to do a beautiful dance with herbs. So it doesn't stay long. It's not like that like ghost pepper burn. It's not a challenge. We want it to be like, ooh, kick in the face, but also the acidity comes in and mellows it out, and then the salinity comes in and mellows it. So it's a wave that you're riding with the spice. So that I think comes from being a Tijuana raised child and consumer. You know, I there's no seafood like the Baja region from the north to the south. And it's a combination of Mexican ingredients, Japanese ingredients, Chinese ingredients, Korean ingredients, and the techniques from all over the world. Because in my opinion, Mexican food is one of the most global inspired cuisines. We wouldn't have one without another culture coming in.
You are the executive chef of Vaga in North San Diego. First of all, what's the inspiration behind the name?
So I had a different name picked out. I started working on the project in 2019. And I, you know, the concept was we're not going to do Mexican. Planting a flag that hard in a hotel, it would make it hard for everyone to be able. And it only had one signature space. So we needed to make sure it was for the masses. I hate the word approachable, so I'm not going to say that. It was for the masses. It was a little bit for everyone. But it was definitely with the intention of having, like I called it, one hand in the ocean and one hand in the farm. And having that through line and me being who I am, there was absolutely going to be a Mexican touch here and there or everywhere. But being really focused on what makes San Diego so special for me, in my opinion, it's the immigrants that make it special. Mm-hmm. So immigrant cuisine was what I really wanted to focus on. If I wanted to do injera on an Ethiopian braise, that was okay because I wasn't appropriating it. I was really paying homage to, it was my love letter to San Diego. So when I opened it, we did Every Country Has a Tortilla themed in my mind. And I told my cooks, I was like, we're going to do Every Country Has a Tortilla. So we did roti, paratas. We did, you know, naan on a day. We did pita on another day. We would do injera. We would do tortillas. So we wouldn't get stuck in a box that we had to be this. And that was really what inspired it. And the name came from, I had Galene, because she is one of Poseidon's children. And I was like, well, we're so close. We're literally on a bluff staring at the ocean. And Galene is the goddess of fair seas. So she makes sure like the fishermen have a perfect calm sea. And I'm like, well, it's very appropriate for opening a new hotel in the middle of a pandemic. We really need her on our side.
Sure.
But a couple of our investors were like, I don't know. So at the end of the day, mind you, this is maybe two creatives in a conversation with 15 people. And finally, one of the owners like raised his hand and he's like, we need to all step away from this conversation and let the creatives do what they do. So the designer, Mark Zeff of the property, and I got on a call and he started asking me things. And he goes, well, what about your name? Your name's beautiful, Claudette. And I was like, well, there's a Claudette in New York, no affiliation, but there's definitely another restaurant named Claudette. And then he asked me what my middle name was. I was like, Aimee, A-I-M-E-E. So the French Amy. Mm-hmm. My Francophiles run deep in Mexico. So Then he started asking me for nicknames. And I was like, well, Tete was because my brother couldn't say, my little brother couldn't say Claudette. So it was Tete. And he's like, well, that sounds like titty. So that's not working at work. And then he was, so that's going to work. And then I said, well, my grandmother always used to call me Baga. And that's a nickname that, in generally speaking, in like culture, you hear Bago because it's a male. It's the masculine version. I'm like, but girls can be vagas too, which means that you're always in the street. And I'm like, I am such a gypsy. The wind turns and my elbow hurts. And I'm like, I must take a flight. And so as soon as I said it, he just looked at me and he like paused for a second. He was like, that's it. And it took literally, I think, 2-3 words that I was just kind of saying nicknames. Mm-hmm. And he goes, it's Vaga. And we went back to the team and it was like, it's Vaga. And it was that conversation with my grandmother every single time I called her on the phone, because I was a single mother before she passed in 2012. I was working 3 jobs and my career was nowhere near what it is now. And I was struggling. I was working at IKEA at the returns department. I was trying to cook in the daytime, cook at nighttime. And she would always start the conversation with, andas de vaga, are you out running around? And I was like, always. I would always say siempre.
Siempre.
And so vaga came to be.
Coming up next, Claudette talks about opening her restaurant Vaga and later reveals what it was like filming with Selena Gomez for Selena Plus Chef, Home for the Holidays.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm sure opening a restaurant is everything that everybody on this podcast has said it is. It's hard. It's rewarding. It's draining. It's all of the things like wrapped up into one. What have you learned since opening this restaurant in 2021?
Oh, I think I can wholeheartedly say this is my favorite opening to date, because I've been doing, to not to be overly hippie, but I've been doing so much work on my generational trauma, on figuring out why my country eats the way what it eats, and also why I am who I am, like what triggers me, how to be a better human, how to be a better leader, mother, daughter. And in that, I've done so much what they call shadow work. And I've done so much like digging up to not have that stereotypical, you know, toxic masculine environment in a kitchen. And in this space, I really wanted to be so intentional. When we opened Alila, which is a property that Vaga sits in, when we opened Alila, it was really leaning in onto the holistic side of life, and that there is absolutely a niche to it. It doesn't have to be, you know, quote unquote hippie. It could just be intentional. you know, and intentionality is something that I really wanted to move forward in. And when I opened in El Jardín in 2018, that was my big word, intention. So opening in 2021 in the middle of the pandemic, I was like, we just need to be so intentional of the people that are here, what's going on in the world and what they're individually going through. Like, we never know what someone's struggling through, right? Immediately, our triggers are to attack anyone that attacks us. But instead of taking a step back and being like, I don't know what you're going through, and I'm just going to give you love and light. And maybe this is just not our time for me. Like, I'd rather walk away from a situation rather than like pounce on my instinct to also get that crazy. So opening this restaurant was leaning hard and wholeheartedly on humanity. We would do, you know, 5:30. We were, you know, the cooks come in at 6 o'clock. Mind you, this is a full big property. It's a quarter of a mile long. So it's a long strip of a hotel or resort. And at the end of the strip, you're met with this bluff, the last like bluff in Southern California, in like San Diego, like SoCal, or my version of SoCal. And that was not constructed on. So it took 30 years for this red tape to finally get through, build. And I saw it from studs to service. And taking my team every morning at 5:30 when they were supposed to get there at 6, they would choose to show up at 5:30 so we could make, I would make them espressos in my little Breville espresso machine in the office. It was like mom's coffee hour, and everyone had their coffee, and then we would walk out together to the bluff and we would just stare at the ocean and breathe. And on our hiring day, or like our first day, we walked down to from the bluff, you can walk down to the stairs on the beach, and everyone picked a rock, and the rock symbolized who you felt you were. Like, what rock you identified with, I called it. And I don't know how I thought about this. I've never seen it before. It sounds very out there. But I said, now in 6 months, we're going to come back down and we're going to pick another rock. And we did this exercise where we put the two rocks next to each other. And the first rock was a little jaggedy. It was a little bit, you know, some of them were beautiful because some of them were already there. And then some of them went from this tiny little rock to all of a sudden they came out with this like mini boulder that was super polished and beautiful. And I was like, think of this as like your personal growth. Mm-hmm. Like, think of this as like, wow, like how far you've come in the safe space that I've given you. So opening Baga we do line yoga. Whenever I show up, it's everyone take a minute and we do, like, no matter if the tickets are like spitting out of the machine and that like insane noise that you hear out of the chip machine that we all like have trauma with and nightmares
like
with.
Nightmares.
Yeah. It didn't matter. And honestly, when we do it and the customers turn around and see that we're doing it, they don't care that their food's going to take an extra 3 minutes because people would show up at 5 p.m. to watch our stretch.
Really?
Yeah. And it was one of the most beautiful. This is a very long-winded answer.
I love it.
It was a very beautiful opening. And I try to keep figuring out who I am so I can become a better leader every single time. And, you know, the staff that's still there from when we opened, they still sage the place. They still, they burn Palo Santo. Like, they still believe, you know, everyone has to drink the Kool-Aid in order for something to work. And they still believe that when we did that, it helped them feel better.
Mm. You've talked before, too, about with your team that you guys have a quote, full-ass approach. Can you kind of explain that a little bit?
Yeah. If something's not worth doing 100%, don't do it. You know, if it's not a hell yes, it's a hell no. One of the, you know, all of those phrases always kind of vibrate in my ears a little bit. And the full ass team is, why would we do anything half? You know, why would we do anything halfway? Why are we going to split ourselves into 10 different things and we're doing everything half-ass? Like, we're a full-ass team. If it means delegating, if it means splitting off into other teams, then we make those decisions, we make those calls. You're not missing out. What is for you will never leave you. What it didn't come to you was never for you. That's kind of all of those, you know, quotes, so to speak, like whatever we want to call them. Like, I'm such a hippie in that kind of sense. And a full ass means if it's worth doing, we're going to do it 100%. And when we do it, we go hard. And it's intimidating to watch, but we do it with so much pleasure. You know, we did it when we did every competition that I'm with my sous team. We do it with so much pleasure. And the other side of the teams that we're going up against look at us like we're crazy. And like, you're doing yoga when the clock already started. And like, yeah, and we'll finish early. Mic drop. Because like,
we'll see you at the finish line.
Yeah, because we're so in tune with each other. And that is that like full ass mentality that I got your back, you got mine. There's no words that need to be said, but we're going to go hard. And when there's time to play, it's time to play.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of what you're describing is not like a typical kitchen environment. So why do you think it's important and why does it work?
It works because people feel seen. And I think that that is the one thing that's so broken in the hospitality industry. And I still feel it's not seen at times. You know, when someone asks me, will you do a catering event? And then they send me the list and it's like, you go in through the back door. I'm sorry, I'm not a backdoor person. I'm sorry, I am not the help. You know, and that's like, we are professionals. We are chefs. We go in through the front door and mm-hmm. we are proud to be here. And so is my staff. We are not the help. We give a service. We are not servants. And that, and teaching my kids, teaching my kids literally and figuratively, my own children as well, that they matter and they take up space. I hate say when people say that the invisibles, hell no. We are 3D. We are here. You can see us. So we are the underestimated. And and teaching my staff, you know, to value themselves and to hold themselves up to the highest standard, regardless of how other people see you, you're gonna respect me because I respect myself. Mm. And that works because seeing someone and you know, one of the best moments in opening Alila is I have one cook, I won't say his name, even though he's one of my favorites. Because he's one of my favorites, I won't say his name. But he was always like, oh, I mean, we opened the pandemic with 14 food and beverage employees and 14 staff members to run one restaurant, one pool restaurant, a coffee shop, and catering. That's insane for a 7-day a week, you know, 3 service operation. And he would always take the 6th day. He would always take the double shifts. And then I saw his face slowly like losing life. And I am really intuitive. So it's like, I know something was wrong and he wouldn't tell me. And he said, Chef, I have anxiety. I pulled the ripcord and I was like, you are no longer on 6 days. You are only in the morning. You are only 5 days. I don't care if you want overtime. You're not allowed overtime until you tell me you're ready for it. And mm-hmm. and the ability to be able to tell your chef, I have anxiety, I need help, was such a moment of me that I'm giving them a safe space to be able to say that. One of my jobs that I had many moons ago is I literally lost my neck because whenever my chef came in, I would do this. And I was on every anti-anxiety med. I was like, I called it my turtleneck. Like I would just like fold into myself because I did not want him to see me. I wanted to become invisible because if he saw me, he would attack me on something. You know, he would throw my prep away or he would tell me what I did was awful. And I was so, it was such a, to not be cheesy, an aha moment, to quote Oprah. It was such an aha moment that I was on my purpose and I was trying to do my part on making these kids with these like severe scars from other restaurants that they came in with feel seen. I mean, to give you an example, we literally gained weight when we opened the restaurant because my cook that was in charge, we did family meal, but it was like loosey goosey. And then one of the prep guys on the team said, you know, I would really love to take family meal. And I was like, go for it. This whole shelf, just knock yourself out. And he would make 3-course meals and breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And he would leave dinner before he left. And he was there, you know, 14 hours a day with a smile on his face. And he told me that one of his chefs one time said at another hotel he was working at, why do you put so much effort in feeding the dogs? And I was like appalled by that. But imagine hearing that and what it felt like. Like, and now this is someone that comes from South America who fled because he couldn't be who he was in that country. And that leaves marks on your soul. Like those fingerprints are just awful to have. So I needed to work on polishing that fingerprint off. And what made that special is because we were all very much seen. Even me, when I was having a bad day, they knew. Like I was very vulnerable in that state of, I'm not in a good place. Give me a minute. And they would give me a minute. And then all of a sudden they would attack me with love. You know, flowers would show up on my desk. My desk was never without flowers.
Oh, I think that speaks a lot to the type of environment that you've created and that just like you said, that safe space for people, which doesn't occur a lot, you know, in the industry, but hopefully more in the future. As you mentioned, you have over, you know, two decades of experience in the industry. So when did getting in front of the camera become part of your career?
I used to hate going to tables. In 2015, I opened a restaurant with another celebrity chef, and I was like, this is going to be a thing because he's never here. Mm-hmm. So obviously, as a CDC, I'm the face. I run this restaurant, and it was a behemoth of a restaurant. It was 250 seats. It was like a nightclub at night. It was, I mean, to the point where I had a walkie-talkie running expo, two different menus, two different floors. It was chaos. The walk-in was in the basement.
Oh my gosh.
A huge undertaking, but we were the first restaurant in San Diego to get nominated for James Beard Best New Restaurant. So obviously I was doing something right, but it came towards the end of my year there, the chef asked me, he was asked by the Top Chef Mexico team, which they had just bought the brand and they had had one season before, they asked for like the next recruits, so to speak. They weren't doing casting like the way we do it in the States because it was so new. So they were going off of, you know, the celebrity chefs in Mexico, putting their chef's name in the hat. So the chef asked me, and you know, Javier Plasencia is one of my big brother's mentors. Between him and Gavin, I think I created a very specific like chef personality and discipline, because Javier is so chaotic and everything he makes is delicious. And Gavin's so disciplined and everything he makes is delicious. So I fell somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
But Javier asked me, you know, they asked me if I knew anyone, I think you should do it. And I was like, I don't even like being at tables. Like it's so much anxiety. Like I'm so awkward and I always say the wrong thing at the wrong time. And he goes, you should just go see how you measure up with your peers, you know, and this is in Mexico. So there's always a little bit of a squeaky wheel from Mexican chefs from Mexico towards Mexican chefs in America or in the United States. But I thrive in uncomfortable situations, and I got fired May of 2016 because I was quote unquote too hard on my team. But I was like, I have 60 kitchen staff members and awards up the wazoo. That doesn't come from me not being disciplined. That doesn't come from me drawing boundaries for the cooks and like, we can have fun, but we have to work. Mm-hmm. And it was a very specific dynamic with, you know, a Mexican company having a woman lead. There's feelings involved. And I said, you know what, the hell with it. I did a stint in the Valle de Guadalupe that summer in 2016. And in August, go figure, in that stint in Valle de Guadalupe, I was helping another chef mentor his CDC on how to be a more empathetic leader. So I'm like, I knew I was in the right. I knew that the right reason why I got let go wasn't a right reason. Like, I was like, no, I'm not going to change who I am. Like, this is how you lead restaurants as a female or as a male. So August 2016, I go to Mexico City for the very first time because I'm from Guadalajara. So Mexico City was this foreign place. You know, my dad used to go there. My family has family friends there, but I'd never been there myself. So 2016, I was a block away from Frida Kahlo's La Casa Azul, her blue house where she was born and died. And I've always had a very specific, special connection with her. And so I went there and I bawled my eyes out and just sat in her garden. And the next day I had a meeting with the director, an on-screen test. And I'm very competitive. I come from a family of all boys. I was the only girl. So I was like, I was born for competition. I am kind of ruthless, but because I'm kind of competing against myself, like I always want to be better than yesterday, but I'm really good at trash talking. So because I have a bunch of brothers, you know, I'm really good at trash talking. So I will give you your one-liners. I will deliver. And September, I want to say 2016, I was on a plane to go film across Mexico because they didn't do it state by state like the US does. We were based in Mexico City. That was our big production studio, but we were traveling to Nayarit. We traveled to Jalisco. We traveled to Michoacán. And going to the open air markets was such a different, we didn't have to go to the grocery store. We went to a market. So very it cool. Just blew the lid, and the cameras were just there. I learned how to zone out from the cameras being there. It's just like being myself. They're in the way usually in a competition setting. You're not supposed to make eye contact, break the fourth wall. Like they're just there, and usually you're jumping over a camera guy going, like cursing at them, like, I'm going to burn you if you don't move. So it becomes this very like weirdly natural space to be in. And then I came home at the end of 2016, and 2017, I said yes to Top Chef US. So that really was like the catalyst, one after another. I shouldn't have done that. Stockholm syndrome, big time. I was a sweetheart in Mexico, but I was very, very traumatized by the time I got to the U.S. for a lot of reasons. But I hadn't done the shadow work. I hadn't really seen myself. But it was such a learning experience, and I don't regret a minute of it. But that was the catalyst for my TV career.
And now it's going strong, I would say.
Yeah. And the camera loves me, apparently. That's what they tell me.
I would agree with that. You know, I saw an interview with you where you talked about, as a kid, you know, not really having anyone who looked like you on screen to kind of look up to. What does it mean to you now to be that person on TV for maybe a young Claudette out there?
You know, and that's the biggest driving force of why I want to keep doing it. Like, the platform in a restaurant is like, say, you know, it's yay big, which is whoever's listening. It's very small. It's like a niche. And then the platform that you have on television, especially nowadays with streaming, like it just grows so exponentially. It grows country to country, right? Like, you can see, people can see me worldwide. And that amount of influence and platform has so much responsibility that comes with it. But I love that I get to give someone hope. I get to give someone the ability to believe and to dream bigger than that they ever thought possible. The thing about our culture and Mexican culture, and I know this transcends other cultures, but I can only speak to mine, is that if you're born in a low socioeconomic tier of humanity, they generally want to keep you there. And no one makes you feel less capable than your own family, than the people around you, because they are so comfortable in that space. They can't fathom seeing someone else that, you know, it could be them, but they can't fathom someone else leaving. Like, how do you escape? This is what we're meant to be. We're meant to be this. We're meant to have scarcity mindset. And I want to buck that rule and be like, no, I'm going to hit that wall and I'm going to break it down. If it doesn't have if that door doesn't exist, let's make a window, and I will crawl. I will, you know, set my own path. And one of my favorites, I mean, daily, I get messages on a day-to-day basis of people that say, you know, because my social media is, I love food, but it's not who I am 100%. Like, it's what I do. It's who I am in my core. But really, it's like humanity. I'm a multidimensional human being. I'm a mother. I'm a spiritual human being that always wants to figure out how to be a better person. So my social media is kind of this mixture of like motivation. Like, I've been there. It's messy. I'm a single mother. I've been a single mother for the last 20 years. That's really messy, you know, and the responsibility that I have to teach, especially my children, to dream big. And if your dreams don't scare you, dream bigger. Like, do everything in fear. I get asked that a lot. Like, how do you push through that fear? I'm like, no, I do everything in fear. Like, before I shoot anything, I am so nervous. My hands are frozen. Like, my hands are cold right now. They're like clammy, and I'm just in my house talking to you. But doing things from that space, I'm always authentically me. And sometimes that's really awkward, and I have ADHD and it's all over the place. And sometimes it's incredibly vulnerable and emotional, and I cry at the drop of a hat, and that's okay, because I am authentically messy, and that gives other people the license to be themselves as well, and to speak up for themselves when someone wants to trample all over them. Like, again, if something is for you, it will never leave you. And you can't look at what other people have and say, I want that too, because that comes from a very negative, like birth point of, like, not only is it scarcity mindset, but it's also jealousy. And that's not a good emotion to have. So celebrating other people's wins is like what I do. I tell myself, like, hell yeah, good job. Like, you know, if I don't know them, I'm like, yeah. And if I do know them, I send them a message. I'm so proud of you. Like, hell yes, this is for you. Because what's for me is going to come to me when it's supposed to. And, you know, the amount of people, because I'm a light-skinned Mexican, is a whole other can of worms. Mm-hmm. You know, like, well, I can't claim brown girl because I'm more of an olive. I'm like, that's such crap. Like, first of all, I'm 30% indigenous. My mother's, you know, three quarters indigenous. Like, I absolutely can claim brown girl energy because it's who I am. And because I'm a Mexican vampire. I don't like the sun. It makes me age faster. Operation is that your sister still going strong 20 years later. And also most people have fake tans. So I don't even want to hear it. I absolutely have brown girl energy. And anyone that tells you that you do not have claim to that energy, and I'm being told that I'm not Mexican, I can't claim brown girl energy, or I'm not brown pride because it's just because I avoid the sun. It's my job. I spent too much money on tattoos to, you know, let the sun damage my skin.
that's a great point as well. Well, I mean, you get to share a lot of that heritage and your skills with fellow Mexican Selena Gomez on Selena and Chef Home for the Holidays, alongside an all-star cast, Eric Agyapong, Alex Guarnaschelli, Michael Simon. We talked about pinch me moments at the top. What was it like to cook in Selena's home alongside of her?
You know, and I think a lot of my Food Network peeps can agree that we've cooked with some really amazing people. Like, a pinch me moment was when Martha Stewart came to my restaurant and like licked the plates clean.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
That's a big pinch me moment.
That is the pinch me moment, probably. Yeah.
The goat came to my restaurant. And when I got the call for Selena, it was immediately, I have a very specific Selena core memory. She went on tour and my daughter was, I think, 8 or 9 or 7. I'm sorry, mom brain.
That's okay.
And she loves Selena. So we are Selena from Wizards of Waverly Place, Selena. Like, that's how back we go where we're Selena fans. And when I got the call, I was like, oh, the first people I told were my children. And it's like, NBA be damned. They're not going to tell anyone. And my son immediately was like, can I go? I mean, he's 20 years old. So he's obviously like crushing on Selena for a different reason.
Of course.
And I was like, no, you can't, but don't be weird. And my daughter pulled out the concert booklet of that tour. And I sent a picture to the producer and I was like, this is what this episode will mean to us. It's like such a full circle moment of the people. Again, and I'm going to be another cheesy, like, you are the sum of the 5 people around you. Like, the people around you are who you want to be. So always strive for having people that are better than you so you can rise up to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And being in the circle of the people that the chefs that are also on this, you know, holiday series. Eric is a great friend of mine, one of my favorite human beings. I've never met Michael. Alex, I was able to judge one of her episodes recently. And there are people that I've been looking up to for the last 20 years. You know, I remember the first time I saw Michael on TV. I remember the first time I saw Alex on TV. And to be able to be in her house, the thing about that I've realized cooking for so many beautiful human beings that are so incredibly successful in their own right in the media world is all they want to be is treated like human beings. So again, in that seeing component, they don't want to be fanned and it's at her house. Like, that is the most sacred space. Like,
right?
Only like 5 people are allowed inside of my house. Most people get met at the porch. So the fact that I was invited into her home, into her sacred space where she absolutely has such a beautiful boundary of like, that's her safe haven. I was very conscious of, I didn't ask her for a selfie. I didn't ask, you know, I didn't take pictures where it was disrespectful. Mm-hmm. And I treated her like she was one of my friends. You know, I called her comadre and I showed her the book and she sat with her little sister and her little sister, I think, wasn't even born when that concert happened. So for them to share those moments and to go through it and to flip through it as like the voyeuristic side, I just was looking at her, see her life evolve and like where she was then to where she is now. It was like, I felt like her big sister. I felt like very maternal in that sense and very protective of her space and honoring her privacy, but to make her feel like one of the girls, you know, like one of my girlfriends cooking, I'm going to show you how to make this food. And, you know, so much of our cuisine is matriarch based. So I really was like the big sister. I wanted to take that role on. So she felt safe.
That's so cool. I mean, what is your favorite part about, you know, guiding somebody new like that through their own cooking journey?
To make mistakes. I mean, I learned English watching Julia Child on TV in Tijuana. So I'm ESL and we learned English watching the Cape, you know, public broadcast TV and her and Jacques' show and her show. Like, I remember watching this very awkward American woman make a lot of people very happy by being herself. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, That's who I aspire to be. So much of our matriarchs in Mexico are like very like, you must do this. What do you mean you don't have freshly milled corn? Like they're hard asses. But my favorite thing to do is be able to walk into someone's home and say, throw the caution to the wind. If you don't have the adaptability mindset, I want to teach every home cook and every, you know, successful human that has nothing to do with food that it's okay to make mistakes and it's okay to read a recipe, a savory recipe, and take it as a guideline, not like final say. It's not a Bible. Like this is something that you can absolutely take and say, I really don't like this. It doesn't mean that you can't make it because you don't like it. Just choose something else that's similar and or completely different and start your own traditions. Because also tradition is another trigger word for me, because two Mexican families living next door to each other can have completely different traditions because they are a meld of lots of different fingerprints. So like make your own traditions. I wanted her to feel so comfortable and we unlocked some beautiful core memories that she had with her grandmother in Texas. Right. And that's where I get my like mojo. It's like, yes, tell me more. The first question I ask people that I meet is, what did you love eating when you were growing up? Everyone has a core memory of food. Everyone does, no matter if it's a good or a bad one. If your mother was an awful cook, it made you a good cook. You know, if your grandma was mean, well, it made you love someone else's grandmother. You know, like we all have these in our human experience. So I'm just trying to get my PhD in humanity.
I think you're well on your way. You talked about, you know, your aunt was like the best hostess. What is the key difference between cooking and entertaining, do you think?
Oh, Doña Lore, my aunt, I swear she never walked. She would wear these giant, so my aunt is this larger than life personality. She always dyed her hair red. And my dad's side is very, very fair skinned, little like Jewish features. Some people think that I'm Arab. Some people, I think that I'm Indian. We're this melting pot. Like we're the United Colors of Benetton in my family. And this human being would float through her dining room in these beautiful, large, like ballet folklorico skirts, red fake nails, like Peggy Bundy. Red lip, so bold. And she was a single mother of six children. She sent all of her kids to the university and they all became attorneys and or entrepreneurs through Pozole. So seeing the power that this woman had to wield someone's comfort levels, like she could literally like manipulate the air around us to make us feel like we were in her cocoon. And time didn't exist at Las Calandrias. We would open the shop at, you know, 6 a.m. I would get sent for 3 months at a time to Guadalajara when I was little. And I would go to the market with her in the morning. I would receive the dessert, the jericayas that would get dropped off on a paint bucket. I was quality control. And seeing her at the register, you know, check everyone out. She took one loan in the life of her restaurant and paid it back with interest within the first year. And she was so strong willed that I'm going to make this on my terms. I'm going to make it on my, and I'm going to make everyone feel so touched. I mean, full soccer team, like the Chivas would just land inside of her restaurant and everyone felt safe. So what she taught me was to be so in tune with people's needs and know them preemptively. Before you know what you want, she knew it. Literally was before someone's hand went up to ask for limes, it landed. She knew out of the corner of her eye, because she worked service. She didn't work in the kitchen. It was like the doñas worked in the kitchen. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see that someone was missing salt on the table. And if there's anything my people always need before they even taste the food is lime and salt. So that, again, that like, shit, that moment of her eyes were everywhere. And it's a sixth sense. You can't, again, one of those things you cannot teach. It's this very specifically in-tuned ability, almost like clairvoyance in her dining room. And I believe I absolutely absorbed it to where I knew if something was going to fall before it fell, I could look up and be like the cobwebs. So my team has a thing where I say, look up, look down, because no one ever looks down in a restaurant because they're so focused on looking at straight. And then they're missing the crumbs. They're missing the fork. They're missing the napkin on the floor, the crumbs that a kid left. And that was her. So she taught me how to be so embedded in her, in my restaurant spaces. Like she became her restaurant space. It's like almost like it spoke to her when it needed something. It's weird, well, but it works.
It's definitely something that it seems like you have inherited from that side of the family for sure. You know, and as we talk about these holiday traditions and recipes, what do you look forward to this time of year?
As my kids get older, my favorite thing, and it's the same, I mean, it was a rite of passage for me too. Like when I was little, it was like, ugh, Christmas time meant making tamales, and making tamales as like in a mob, right? My grandmother, like, yeah, Henry Ford created the automation system. No, they didn't. No, Mexican mothers did. Because if you ever built tamales, there was an automation line before it was a thing. Like we created that well before anyone else did. But what I now look forward to is when my kids were little, they were the same. Ah, God, no, can I just come in and eat? Like they would like zoom in like seagulls, take a snack and leave. And now I force them to do it with me and not force them in a negative way. But I do tell them like it's just the three of us. We're the three musketeers. And if you don't take all of this from me and ask the questions to my mom, who's their last living grandparent, like you're going to miss a big chunk of who you are and why you are, how you are. So ask the questions, get in the kitchen and make tamales. And that was Selena's takeaways. She remembers making tamales with her grandmother. And so I look most forward to making memories with my children that are their own, but like rooted in mine. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom learned how to cook when she met my dad. Before that, she never cooked because my grandmother helped her raise my two older brothers or my half brothers. So my mom worked, she was a manager at a bank. So my grandmother helped raise my older two siblings. And when she met my dad had the most like gourmand palate. He immigrated to Los Angeles in the 60s when it was like the heyday of like haute cuisine and, you know, Wolfgang was becoming Wolfgang. And so in Tijuana, we were eating the most random stuff. I mean, I remember eating escargot when I was four. I remember eating like steamed artichokes with drawn butter because my mom saw it on TV. And this was very unlike most Tijuana households. You know, we were eating Chinese chicken salad of like the LA Chinese chicken salad that became famous and obviously not Chinese, but it has its own category. And I was eating that food. And so showing my kids and telling them those stories and then having them make their own memories is like, that's what the holidays are about. They're out of school. They're both at San Diego State, you know, holler Aztec moms. and the good thing about both of my children is they actually love family time. And while I'm such a hermit and can absolutely be alone and love my solitude, they force me to create those memories with them and like to bring family in. And my son thrives in that environment. He thrives in chaos, that family chaos. So I know it comes from me. I've just learned to love my solitude in my older age, but making those food memories with them and like that chaos of, you know, their uncle's kids screaming and my brother has four boys all under the age of 11. And it's like it's chaos, utter chaos. And while I love silence now, I know that they need it because that's going to make fingerprints for them and that's going to make memories for them.
Yeah, they're going to have, maybe they'll be talking about those core memories in a podcast interview.
Exactly.
In 15 years or something like that. Well, this has been so much fun chatting with you, getting to know you. We're going to finish things off with a little rapid fire round. And then we have one final question for you.
Okay.
So rapid fire round, what's on your kitchen playlist?
Ooh, well, it depends on the mood. But right now I'm really into Lil Wayne.
Okay.
Between Lil Wayne and Shania Twain. Those are my two.
And everything in between. If there was an episode of Claudette's Favorite Things, what would you be giving away?
Fashion and makeup. I'm a sucker for it. Beauty and fashion.
All right.
Yeah.
Every Mexican household has blank.
Screaming women. it has a tortilla press.
Okay. Most sentimental tattoo.
Oh, that's a hard one. So I have a cannoli
You can see here. I have a cannoli.
One of my servers at El Jardín, he passed away very suddenly of a heart attack. And he used to, it was a Sunday brunch, we would do pan dulce. He would always walk through because he was a Jersey boy, an Irish Jersey boy. So he had a hard Jersey accent. And he would walk past my pan dulce and he was like, "What is this, chef? A cannoli?" he would call Concha's cannolis. And so I have a cannoli in his memory. And that's one of my most recent and most treasured tattoos.
All right. What's your next tattoo?
Frida Kahlo has some beautiful live food paintings that I'm going to wrap one of my legs in.
Oh my gosh, that sounds incredible.
Similar to the tablescape in Selena's, that fruit tablescape, that's going to go wrapped around my leg.
That's so cool. All right, our final question is not rapid fire. And this is a question we ask everybody at the end of our interviews. They're all different. So it's just what would be on the menu for your perfect food day? So we're talking breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert. You can travel in between meals, you know, do whatever you want to make your perfect day. We want to hear about it. So take us through it.
Oh, my perfect day starts in Paris and starts with a like delicious cafe au lait and sitting in a little tiny table with the best croissant of your life, followed by a hamburger and walking around every single arrondissement in Paris. Mm-hmm. Then I go for lunch. Where will I go for lunch? Yeah, I'll go to Oaxaca for lunch. Okay. I'll go to Oaxaca for lunch in the center square of Oaxaca where the cathedral's at and have a beautiful, what they call empanadas, which is just like a tortilla with shredded, like mole amarillo is one of my favorites, like shredded chicken or turkey with mole amarillo in a tortilla, freshly made tortilla. And you're just watching this people. I love watching people live their life, that like sick kind of pleasure you get from voyeuristically like people watching. And then dinner is coming home. Dinner is having my mom make sopita, which we call sopa de fideo. My daughter calls it sopita. For a starter, it's pasta sauteed with like an aromatic onion and garlic with a tomato-based soup. You have that as a starter. Then you go into your albondigas al chipotle, which my mom makes so deliciously, stuffed with a hard-boiled egg. My mom has been doing this my entire life. People ask me where it comes from. I'm like, it's kind of like my mom's Scottish egg, but it's delicious. I make it for my kids, but my mom's is still better. And finish off with arroz con leche that my mom makes with folded meringue in the rice pudding.
Oh, wow. I mean, that sounds perfect. It sounds like exactly all the things that we talked about. And thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your life with us and hopefully more pinch me moments in 2024.
Oh, let's put that out there. Absolutely more pinch me moments. Thank you so much, Jamie.
You can catch Claudette on the new special Selena Plus Chef Home for the Holidays, streaming now on Max. Make sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a thing. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review. We love it when you do that. That's all for now. And we will catch you foodies after the holidays. We will be back with new episodes on January 26th. See you in the new year.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.